Welcome back to the Hemingway List, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. We are today reading Book 5, Chapter 8. We're reading Chapter 8. No, we're not. That was wrong. I've already made a mistake. We're reading Book 6, Chapter 1, aren't we? Yes, we are. But first, we're going to review and discuss Book 5, Chapter 7. Off to a good start here. Alright. Book 5, Chapter 7. The questions I asked is, geez, Fyodor, needy much? What do you think Grushenka is playing at? And will Ivan really stay in Moscow, I meant to say, not say, or will he come crawling back? Tekrific said, Ivan is slowly becoming unhinged. He oscillates between irrational fear and having violent thoughts about Smurdy. He's very unstable. He's even feeling hatred towards Alyosha as well as himself. The very fabric of his being is unravelling in this chapter. He's been told by Smurdy to obtain an alibi, and it's hinted that Dmitri is definitely going to murder their father. And I guess Ivan's behaviour should be interpreted as his guilty conscience manifesting itself, plaguing him, torturing him to act, to try to stop this. Fyodor is becoming unhinged too. Grushenka has really crept under his skin, and it's an itch Fyodor can't scratch because Grushenka is nowhere in sight. I wonder if she's with Mitya and or with the Polish fellow. Fyodor is really obsessing over Grushenka. Obsessing. It's quite kind of alarming, scary behaviour. And apparently one of the brothers is going to murder their dad, which just comes out of nowhere for me. Like, I know they don't like him, but weren't they just at some monastery with him like a few chapters ago? And I don't know, I got no sense that there was some huge blow up. I know that they're fighting over the girl, but geez, suddenly they're just going to kill the guy. So it's like, alright, that escalated quickly. I suppose it's because, like, I haven't really seen any emotions from any of the characters in this book, really. Like, it's been told, like, he did this, he did that, and like he was this, he was that, but like nothing, it sinks in. It's sort of like just paper cutouts of people flittering around the page for me. So there's no real depth to any of these characters. And I think it's because they keep explaining their depth at length rather than showing any actual depth. Actions speak much louder than words, and all their words, all about what they believe, what they think. I don't know. It's not how people conduct themselves. And now one of them is a murderer. Potentially. Kind of, I don't know. I really struggle to follow this book. Like, nothing sinks in. Somastar says, I agree with you about the two becoming unhinged and would throw Dmitri in there too. When Smurdy had his fit at the end of the chapter, it made me remember yesterday's chapter and how he was talking of a fit coming on. So I went back and re-skimmed yesterday's chapter. In doing so, I became more aware of how Smurdy is feeling a lot of anxiety in the family. He's the one sharing secrets amongst people who shouldn't or don't need to know them. He's the one spreading rumours. He claims he's doing it to prove his loyalty to various family members or ensure his own safety, but one really has to wonder about his motivations. Is he purposefully trying to rile up the family members against one another? Is he purposefully building a powder keg and then putting a match to it? Very interesting. Uncle Drosselmeyer said, Smurdy, that little devil. I bet Alfred Hitchcock got fond of him. Uncle Drosselmeyer also said, Fyodor shows, again, that his needs are more important than everyone else's. Ivan is manifesting an erratic behaviour, but Fyodor puts more tension over his son by asking him for a last-minute favour. Smediakov got an epileptic seizure, but Fyodor just cares about his tasteless food. His house is a mess, but he is longing for Grushenka. Maybe Grushenka hasn't appeared because he is so needy and demanding. I think that kind of behaviour would be very unattractive for any potential partner. If someone's, you know, asked you to come over and you're like, okay, I might come over, and then they're waiting by the door and demanding that people listen for a certain amount of different knocks and all these things, and he's just waiting, obsessed the whole time, I would probably be back off and be like, yeah, you know what, I might not come over. You seem a little maybe clingy-ish. Like, have your own thing going on, Theodore. Yeah. Very scary behaviour. I am Norwegian said, this chapter was a nice change of pace. Ivan, lying in bed, full of messy and conflicting emotions, was strangely insightful in its description. It's another one of those things which I haven't seen articulated before, and yet it feels familiar. I doubt he will stay in Moscow. I doubt Ivan will come crawling back. He will have better pretext because he could not bear crawling, but I'm very sure he will be back. Fyodor is needy because he needs money, probably because he is trying to entice Grushenko by a stupid amount of money in the envelope. I'm not sure why he isn't sending Smurdy. I remembered that Fyodor once dropped 100 rubles, that which Smurdy found and gave back without prompting. Though I guess it doesn't matter with Smurdy's fit. I laughed when they described his falling down the stairs as annoying. The fit is probably an act, a nice way to escape the storm that it has been brewing. Herzentube is called, and again proves himself mostly useless. Wow, okay, so an act, do you reckon? An act? I don't think so, but that would be really interesting if it was just an act. It'd be really quite amusing, funny. Techrific said, Herzentube, utterly nutzlos, as the Germans would say. Whenever I see his name, I smile involuntarily because his name is so ridiculous. Herzen is a verb for cuddles or caress, or to caress, sorry, and tube is a tube, so it's a tube of cuddles, which is probably about as useful as his remedies are. It's just a tube with some good will in it, but no actual medicinal value. Now, that scene about Ivan lying in bed with his conflicting emotions, I don't know if you listen. I think some people listen to the discussion part of the podcast, but not the reading part. But my God, what that bit was so frustrating to read. It was like so tautological. It kept repeating the same bit of information 4, 5, 6 times across, you know, 2 or 3 sentences. Which, like, twice, you want to be careful. Like, when you, as a writer, when you repeat, if the same bit of information is conveyed twice, it's like, okay, that's, at that point you're reiterating, so you're stressing that point because it's crucial and you don't want the reader to have missed it if they weren't paying attention. But 5, 6 or more times, at that point you're just messing with the readers. You're wasting their time, essentially, and it was like that. And then it went on to say this sentence like, you know, he had these thought processes going on, but I won't explain those to you now, right? Which is like, leave that sentence out. Like, you don't have to tell us you're not going to tell us something. But then it goes on to give you a good, like, I don't know, 15, 20, like a good long paragraph, 15, 20 sentences about his thought processes, which they just said they weren't going to explain. And it's half a page, which is quite long. It's a good 400 words or so. Actually, I'll tell you how long it is. Word count. I'm looking at it right now. It's 300 words, sorry, which basically says he stayed up late because he couldn't stop thinking. And that's it. And they spend, you know, 2 minutes of your time just to sort of say that in the most roundabout and repetitive way. So I know I'm critiquing the writing on this a lot, but, you know, every day I'm bitching about the writing. And not, maybe if you don't listen to the reading part, not hearing an example like me explain myself on why I think the writing is so bad. Now, you can't really argue with me, I think. I mean, you can, but you can't argue that the writing's not bad, because literally Tolstoy was trying to make the writing bad. Like, that was his goal. The only case you can make is, like, because he did it on purpose, that doesn't mean he's a bad writer. He did a good impression of bad writing, but it still means the writing is bad and tedious to read. So I really can't wrap my head around how so many people love the prose. I just don't understand. Let me give you a little bit of this bit from yesterday. Also, let me preface this by saying that the thing I love about writing and any art is the rulelessness. There is no rule. So here I am saying this rule like, you know, you don't want to be too tautological. But you can, of course. And some people might love that. And so, yeah, just with a grain of salt, sort of against myself, like, the thing I love about any art is how you can do whatever you want around the rules, and there is no one to say not to. With that said, I still found the end product very frustrating. So he said this, just a little example, and for me, every sentence of this book has been riddled with the kind of criticisms I'm about to make just about this little random section. So it says, this is talking about Ivan, it was very late, but Ivan was still awake and reflecting. He sat up late that night. Okay, so it's already said it was very late, and he was still awake. Okay, he sat up late that night. That's the same bit of information as the first sentence. And then it says, until 2 o'clock, which is late. Okay, so that's saying 2 o'clock. That's the third time so far they've told us it was late, and they've told us twice that he was still awake. It was very late, but Ivan was still awake and reflecting. He sat up late that night until 2 o'clock. You could say, Ivan stayed up until 2 o'clock reflecting that night. Something, anything. You could shorten that so many different ways. Okay. And then it goes on to say, this is just the most pointless sentence. Just cut it out of the book. But we will not give an account of his thoughts, and this is not the place to look into that soul. Its turn will come. Okay. You don't have to tell us what you're not about to say. Just don't say it. Easy. But then the stupidest thing is that they then do say it. Like, we won't give an account, because this is not the time and place. And then it goes on to say, and even if one tried, it would be very hard to give an account of them, for there were no thoughts in his brain, but something very vague, and above all, intense excitement. Okay, so now you've started giving an account of his thoughts that you just said you weren't going to do. He felt himself that he had lost his bearings. Okay? That's very much like saying he had vague thoughts, no thoughts at all, intense excitement. He'd lost his bearings, okay? He was fretted too, okay? So he was fretting about something, yep. You know, we kind of had that in the first sentence, just where you say he stayed awake reflecting. You can kind of gather that he was fretting about something, but hey, tell us for the 10th time. He was fretted too, by all sorts of strange and almost surprising desires. For instance, after midnight, he suddenly had an intense... Okay, and then it goes on and on about the different things he's thinking for a good... Like, I'm not even a third of the way through that chunk I was describing, that 300 words. So then it does continue to tell you his thoughts, which it just said they wouldn't. And in the same, you know, it goes on, it's repetitive, it's, you know... And by the end of it, we basically take away that he stayed awake thinking, and he couldn't stop. It's just, honestly, it's so tedious for me to read. Like, you could do an abridged version of this book and reduce it from, I reckon, I think it's 700,000 words. You could probably reduce it to, like, you know, if I was to reduce that sentence down to what I think it should be, that paragraph of 300 words, I would say I could knock it out in 50 words, maybe 100, so 1/14th to 1/7th of the length, which would make the book 50 to 100,000 words instead of 700,000. Now I know, you know, Dostoevsky goes into depth about what his characters are about, and you know, you couldn't do that in 50,000 words or 100,000 words, but I'm just saying that the repetitiveness of the book is nauseating. Like, it's so frustrating, and that's why I am getting so frustrated by the book, and why I can't understand how other people aren't getting frustrated, because for me every paragraph is the same problems, like extremely repetitive, the same bit of information being conveyed sometimes a dozen times, and then also like, just pointless bits. That's like, you could have just left that out. Like, that's just a nothing sentence. It reminds me a lot of when I used to work in corporate, in IT, and people would write these documents, and because they didn't know what they were writing, they would make them sound extremely complex and just really fill them up with as much jargon and they'd make them extremely long and convoluted and complex. And they were just saying really very simple schematics or instructions for a programmer, and didn't need to be complex at all. But the reason that they did made it so difficult to interpret was so that their uppers, their managers, wouldn't be able to see that they didn't know what they were doing, because they didn't know what they were doing, right? They didn't know what they were doing. So, what am I saying? The managers who aren't an expert in reading technical documents would look at this document and go, yep, that all looks right. And in their head, they're like, geez, that's confusing and very, very complex. What a smart guy this guy must be. I'll just take his word for it that it's right. But it wasn't right. And then my job would be to come along and pick apart these documents and try to make sense out of them. And I'd be reading these sentences over and over, being like, what are they? How come I can't figure this out? Like, for the life of me, I can't make sense of this. And it would be this long, complex sentence, which I'd like take and pick apart and iron it out and try to figure out what the hell they're saying, only to realize that it didn't make sense. That the sentence was just a big, complex thing that didn't make sense. And the reason I couldn't figure it out wasn't because I wasn't smart enough. It was because it didn't make sense. I was trying to make sense out of nonsense. And now I'm not accusing Dostoevsky of doing that here. All I'm saying is that it feels like the same thing. Like, he's made it way more complicated and convoluted than it needs to be in order to seem, I don't know, like it has more depth or it's more intelligent, more intellectual. When I think the most intellectual people will take it and make it simple, rather than the other way around, take a simple thing and make it extremely difficult to understand. I don't know. I also think that whole thing about him intentionally making it bad writing is just a cop-out. I think he wrote this lazily. It seems like to me it was like dictated to somebody, which I think it may have been, but it reads to me like someone just spoke it into a dictaphone and then had someone transcribe it, and that's why it's so like wordy. And then I think he was like, oh, no, I'm doing an impression of bad writing. That's why it sucks, right? But I think it's like, nah, dude, you just couldn't be bothered doing the editing. It seems very unedited. So, anyway, those are my gripes with this text. That's why I'm complaining about it every day. Now, let's continue. Hey, let's keep reading this thing. Book 6 is called The Russian Monk, and Chapter 1 is called Father Zossima and His Visitors. When, with an anxious and aching heart, Alyosha went into his elder's cell, he stood still, almost astonished. Instead of a sick man at his last gasp, perhaps unconscious, he had feared to find him, he saw him sitting up in his chair, and though weak and exhausted, his face was bright and cheerful. He was surrounded by visitors and engaged in a quiet and joyful conversation, but he had only got up from his bed a quarter of an hour earlier, before Alyosha's arrival. His visitors had gathered together in his cell earlier, waiting for him to wake, having received a most confident assurance that Father Pacey, that the teacher would get up and, as he had himself promised, in the morning converse once more with those dear to his heart. This promise, and indeed every word of the dying elder Father Pacey, put implicit trust in. If he had seen him unconscious, if he had seen him breathe his last, and yet had his promise that he would rise up and say goodbye to him, he would not have believed, perhaps even in death, but would still have expected the dead man to recover and fulfill his promise. In the morning, as he lay down to sleep, Father Zossima had told him positively, "I shall not die without the delight of another conversation with you, beloved of my heart. I shall look once more on your dear face and pour out my heart to you once again." The monks who had gathered for his probably last conversation with Father Zossima had all been his devoted friends for many years. There were four of them: Father Yusuf, and Father Pacey, Father Mihail, the warden of the Hermitage, a man not very old and far from being learned. He was of humble origin, of strong will and steadfast faith, of austere appearance, but of a deep tenderness, though he obviously concealed it as though he were almost ashamed of it. The fourth, Father Anfim, was a very old and humble little monk of the poorest peasant class. He was almost illiterate and very quiet, scarcely speaking to anyone. He was the humblest of the humble, and looked as though he had been frightened by something great and awful beyond the scope of his intelligence. Father Zossima had a great affection for this timorous man, and always treated him with marked respect, though perhaps there was no one he had known to whom he had said less, in spite of the fact that he had spent years wandering about Holy Russia with him. That was very long ago, 40 years before, when Father Zossima first began his life as a monk in a poor and little monastery at Kostroma, and when, shortly after, he had accompanied Father Afim on his pilgrimage to collect alms for their poor monastery. The whole party were in the kitchen, which, as we mentioned before, was very small, so there was scarcely room for the four of them, in addition to Porphyry, the novice, who stood to sit round Father Zossima on chains brought from the sitting room. It was already beginning to get dark. The room was lighted up by lamps and the candles before the icons. Seeing Alyosha standing embarrassed in the doorway, Father Zossima smiled at him joyfully and held out his hand. "Welcome, my quiet one. Welcome, my dear. Here you are too. I knew you would come." Alyosha went up to him, bowed down before him to the ground, and wept. Something surged up from his heart. His soul was quivering. He wanted to sob. "Come, don't weep over me yet," Father Zossima smiled, laying his right hand on his head. "You see, I am sitting up talking. Maybe I shall live another 20 years yet, as that dear good woman from Vishigori, with her little Lizaveta in her arms, wished me yesterday. God bless the mother and the little girl, Lizaveta." He crossed himself. "Porphyry, did you take her offering where I told you?" He meant the 60 kopecks brought him the day before by the good-humoured woman to be given to someone poorer than me. Such offerings always, of money gained by personal toil, are made by way of penance voluntarily undertaken. The elder had sent Porphyry the evening before to a widow, whose house had been burnt down lately, and who, after the fire, had gone with her children begging alms. Porphyry hastened to reply that he had given the money, as he had been instructed, from an unknown benefactress. "Get up, my dear boy," the elder went on to Alyosha. "Let me look at you. Have you been home and seen your brother?" It seemed strange to Alyosha that he asked so confidently and precisely about one of his brothers only, but which one? Then perhaps he had sent him out both yesterday and today for the sake of that brother. "I have seen one of my brothers," answered Alyosha. "I mean the older one, to whom I bowed down." "I only saw him yesterday and could not find him today," said Alyosha. "Make haste to find him. Go again tomorrow and make haste. Leave everything and make haste. Perhaps you may still have time to prevent something terrible. I bowed down yesterday to the great suffering in store for him." He was suddenly silent and seemed to be pondering. The words were strange. Father Yusuf, who had witnessed the scene yesterday, exchanged glances with Father Pacey. Alyosha could not resist asking. "Father and teacher," he began with extreme emotion, "your words are too obscure. What is this suffering in store for him?" "Don't inquire. I seemed to see something terrible yesterday, as though his whole future was expressed in his eyes. A look came into his eyes, so that I was instantly horror-stricken at what that man is preparing for himself. Once or twice in my life I've seen such a look in a man's face, reflecting, as it were, his future fate, and that fate, alas, came to pass. I sent you to him, Alexei, for I thought your brotherly face would help him. But everything and all our fates are from the Lord. Except a corn of wheat fall into the ground and die. It abideth alone, but if it die, it bringeth forth much fruit. Remember that. You, Alexei, I have many times silently blessed for your face. Know that," added the elder with a gentle smile. "This is what I think of you. You will go forth from these walls, but will live like a monk in the world. You will have many enemies, but even your foes will love you. Life will bring you many misfortunes, but you will find your happiness in them, and will bless life and will make others bless it, which is what matters most. Well, that is your character. Fathers and teachers," he addressed his friends with a tender smile, "I have never, till today, told him even why the face of this youth is so dear to me. Now, I will tell you, his face has been, as it were, a remembrance and a prophecy for me. At the dawn of my life, when I was a child, I had an older brother who died before my eyes at 17, And later on, in the course of my life, I gradually became convinced that that brother had been for a guidance and a sign from on high for me. For had he not come into my life, I should never, perhaps so I fancy at least, have become a monk and entered onto this precious path. He appeared first to me in my childhood, and here, at the end of my pilgrimage, he seems to have come to me over again. It is marvellous, fathers and teachers, that Alexei, who has some, though not a great, resemblance in face, seems to me so like him spiritually, that many times I have taken him for that young man, my brother, mysteriously come back to me, at the end of my pilgrimage, as a reminder and an inspiration, so that I positively wondered at so strange a dream in myself. Do you hear this, Porphyry? He turned to the novice who waited on him. Many times I've seen in your face, as it were, a look of mortification that I love Alexei more than you. Now, you know why that was so, but I love you too, that know that. And many times I grieved at your mortification. I should like to tell you, my dear friends, of that youth, my brother, for there has been no presence in my life more precious, more significant and touching. My heart is full of tenderness, and I look at my whole life at this moment as though living through it again. Here I must observe that this last conversation of Father Zossima with the friends who visit him on the last day of his life has been partly preserved in writing. Alexei Fyodorovich Karamazov wrote it down from memory sometime after his oldest death. But whether this was only the conversation that took place then, or whether he added to it his notes of parts of former conversations with his teacher, I cannot determine. In his account, Father Zossima's talk goes on without interruption, as though he told his life to his friends in the form of a story, though there is no doubt from other accounts of it that the conversation that evening was general. The guests did not interrupt Father Zossima much, yet they too talked, perhaps even told something themselves. Besides, Father Zossima could not have carried on an uninterrupted narrative, for he was sometimes gasping for breath, his voice failed him, and he even lay down to rest on his bed, though he did not fall asleep and his visitors did not leave their seats. Once or twice the conversation was interrupted by Father Pasi's reading the gospel. It is worthy of note, too, that no one of them supposed that he would die that night, for on that evening of his life, after his deep sleep, in the day he seemed suddenly to have found new strength, which kept him up through this long conversation. It was like a last effort of love which gave him marvellous energy, only for a little time, however, for his life was cut short immediately. But of that later. I will only add now that I have preferred to confine myself to the account given by Alexei Fyodorovich Karamazov. It will be shorter and not so fatiguing, though, of course, as I must repeat, Alyosha took a great deal from previous conversations and added them to it. All right, that's the end of chapter 1, book 6. So I love, that's so funny that now the author is trying to be like, oh, maybe it's not very natural that people, when they talk, seem to just be able to tell like a 7-page diatribe without anyone interrupting. Maybe I should start to try to explain how that's the case. Okay, so this is Alyosha writing down what Zossima said, and of course he took out the interruptions and also added in other bits himself. Yeah, cool, that covers me for my terrible writing. Yeah, cool. It's just so, I don't know. It's ridiculous. So I just feel like I can see through that a mile away. Like, yeah, cool. Cover yourself. Cover up your laziness there. Can't figure out how to make it a conversation. You just want to do a diatribe. Cool. I just want to say this next chapter into my dictaphone. So how can I make it like that's how the guy would have said? Oh, I know. It'll be a written account of what he said. Oh, that's pathetic. It's pathetic. I don't understand how no one else sees the laziness and the poor quality of this writing. It's hilarious. What else was he saying there? Oh yeah, so it's not too fatiguing. That's so funny, because clearly the author is not at all concerned with fatiguing his readers. In fact, it seems like he's trying to do that in as much as possible. Alright, that's going to do us for today. Thank you very much for listening. Look forward to seeing what you've got to say over at the subreddit, and I'll see you tomorrow.